Welcome to this podcast from the Commonwealth Club of California, a nonprofit, nonpartisan forum open to the public. I'm Gloria Duffy, President and CEO of the club. To learn more about events or membership, join us online at commonwealthclub.org.
Good evening and welcome to today's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California. I'm Paul Clark. I'm a member of the Forum on Asia-Pacific Affairs, and I'm your chair for today's speaker. And now it's my pleasure to introduce our distinguished guest speaker, Dr. Neil Jock, who'll speak to us on U.S.-Pakistan Next Steps for Troubled Friends. Neil Jock is a senior fellow at the Center for Global Security Research at Lawrence Livermore National Laboratory. And from 2004 to 2005, he served as the Director for Counterproliferation Strategy at the National Security Council at the White House. Here he was primarily responsible for India and Pakistan proliferation issues. And from 2003, he was a member of the policy planning staff at the State Department, where his responsibilities included India, Pakistan, Afghanistan, and nuclear proliferation portfolios. Quite a lot to deal with. He received the Superior Honor Award for work on Afghanistan following the September 11th attacks. In addition to that, he's also the editor of two books, Arms Control and International Security, and Strategic Consequences of Nuclear Proliferation in South Asia. Very accomplished man, a great speaker on this topic, and I'd like you to give a big hand to Dr. Neil Jock.
Thank you very much, Paul. Thank you for that kind introduction, and thank you all for taking time out of your schedule to attend this talk. Are we okay on sound? Good. I've given each of you a map or set of maps about Pakistan, and if anyone didn't get one, there's some at the back and there are others here in front. The reason I did that is not to clutter up your briefcases, but because in order to understand the topic of today's talk, the future of relations between the United States and Pakistan, I always think it's important to try and back up a little bit to get a good feel for why Pakistan sees the world the way it does. And inevitably, a lot of that has to do with its geostrategic position in the world. So let me just, by way of introduction, point to the first map that you have, which simply is a political map showing Pakistan in a very tough neighborhood, as is frequently said, primarily because of its relationship with India, but also because of its bordering on Afghanistan, and I'll talk a little bit about why that's problematic for Pakistan and why the resolution of the Afghanistan war is very problematic for Pakistan in its sense of its own security. And as you look to the north, you see what are sometimes called the, I think it's the seven stands, but the number of new republics that formed when the Soviet Union collapsed. And also, Pakistan's a neighbor of China, and China has been a good friend to Pakistan. So this positions Pakistan geostrategically. And it helps to explain a lot of Pakistan's security concerns. What I would like to do tonight is talk a little bit about Pakistan's views of its position and how regional stability affects Pakistan's view of itself and its future. The second part of the talk, I'd like to go into a little bit of the U.S.-Pakistan relationship, heavily on the background of the U.S.-Pakistan relationship, to give some sense for why Pakistan now sees itself in a position of some insecurity, and to try and help understand why Pakistan views the resolution of the Afghanistan war and its own relationship with the Taliban in certain ways that are hard for us to see without that background. Third area advertised in the brochure was to look at the future of nuclear weapons. And it's important to understand why nuclear weapons are important to Pakistan and why many concerns in the West about the security of those weapons. And the nexus between Pakistan's connection with the Taliban and support for terrorism in the past and its acquisition of nuclear weapons is something that we should all be very worried about, but nobody worries about it more than the Pakistanis themselves. So a few words about that. And then the last section of the talk will be, in a sense, to look at the title, finally, of the talk. That is, what are next steps in the U.S.-Pakistan relationship? Okay, looking at regional stability, it's important to understand, in order to understand why we are where we are, Pakistan's origins. A lot of Pakistan's sense of its own strategic concern arises from its history of having previously been part of British India. And in 1947, when Great Britain was essentially thrown out of South Asia, Pakistan was formed as an independent country. If you look at the second map in your stack, it's a map of the Kashmir region. And when Pakistan and India were divided, Kashmir became a bone of contention between the two. Pakistan was formed in the vision of its founder, Muhammad Ali Jinnah, as a homeland for the Muslims of South Asia, the Muslims in British India. From Pakistan's view, Kashmir should have been included as part of Pakistan. In the end, it was not, for a number of strategic reasons having to do with India's views of its own identity as a secular state, with India's views of its expected long-term conflict with China, and also for personal reasons, the first Prime Minister of India, Jawaharlal Nehru's family home was in Kashmir. So for a number of reasons, Kashmir became divided. And as the two states were formed in 1947, they immediately broke into conflict over the future of Kashmir. And that conflict has never been resolved. It continues to be a bone of contention between the two sides. And as you look at the map, it's somewhat difficult to see. There's a red line surrounding the entirety of Kashmir. There's a section in the top called the Northern Areas that is controlled by Pakistan. There's a dotted line separating the part at the bottom called Jammu and Kashmir, which is controlled by India. And then you see two areas to the east, one called Aksai Chin and the other with no identifying marks. The one Aksai Chin is contested between India and China. It continues to be occupied by China but claimed by India. And the other section is also controlled by China but in effect has been ceded by Pakistan to China, which again is part of the contentious argumentation that goes on between India and Pakistan over Kashmir. There's another part to thinking about Pakistan that animates why Pakistan feels the way it does in its environment. And that has to do with the origin not just of the state, but of the name. And there are two explanations, and both of them are correct, about where Pakistan, the name, comes from. As you look at the first map, there are all these different stans, Tajikistan, Kazakhstan, and so on. What that means is land of the Kazakhs, land of the Kyrgyz, land of the Turks, Turkmenistan, and so on. There's no ethnic group of people called Paks. So why is Pakistan land of the Paks? What Pakistan is an acronym that stands for the different parts of Pakistan. And that brings us to the last map in your collection, which shows some of the major ethnic groups within Pakistan. And in fact, the name Pakistan was developed back in the 1930s by a set of graduate students in England, students from South Asia who were studying in England. They came up with the idea of the Muslim parts of Pakistan, the Muslim parts of British India that would then be put together to form the new state. So as you look at this ethnic group, the P in Pakistan stands for Punjab. The A stands for not Afghanistan, but for Afghania, the region between the two sides. And on this map, it's marked as Pashtuns. But in this formulation of an idea for Pakistan, it was Afghania. The S is for Sindh, that region at the bottom in yellow, which is where the Sindhis live. And the T-A-N at the end was for Baluchistan, that pink area in the bottom left of that map. The K in the middle of Pakistan stands for Kashmir. So from a sense of identity, Kashmir is central to Pakistan. And from the point of view of an identity as a Pakistani, it captures why it's difficult for Pakistanis to see themselves and to identify themselves in the world, in the region. It creates a certain sense of insecurity. So Pakistan is this combination of different elements, and it's always been a central challenge to Pakistan to bring these elements together, to make them all feel part of the nation of Pakistan, as opposed to being a Punjabi, or being a Pashtun, or being a Sindhi, or being a Kashmiri. And that continues to be a problem for Pakistan as it tries to make itself secure in the world. Ethnic politics and ethnic identity are not going away and are captured also in Pakistan's view of Afghanistan. Now, you see that there's this large area that's in light green, originally referred to as Afghania, or thought of as Afghania for the acronym. But it's composed of very strongly nationalistic people, the Pashtuns. And you see that they're on both sides of the border. So from Pakistan's point of view, as it sought to bring all its people together, it faced the problem of a large minority in its own country, the Pashtuns, who are also, in fact, the majority in the neighboring country of Afghanistan. So there's a history of tension between Pakistan and Afghanistan that has never really been resolved. And when we get further into the talk, I'll say a little bit more about why Pakistan's view of Afghanistan is complicated by these people, the Pashtun people who live on both sides of the border and basically form the identity of the Taliban. So I'll come back to that. One last thing with respect to the name for Pakistan, it does represent these different people, but it also has a Farsi meaning. In Farsi, the language of Iran, which is also widely spoken and understood in Pakistan, Pakht is the ritual cleansing of the hands before one goes into the temple to pray, into the mosque to pray. And so what Pakistan means is not land of any particular ethnic group called Pakhts, but land of the pure, land of the people who wash their hands and cleanse their hands before going in to pray in the mosque, Pakistan, land of the pure. So Pakistan has this mixture of ethnic identity and religious identity, but never a national identity of the country as a whole. Let me talk a little bit about the history of the U.S.-Pakistan relationship and how Pakistan saw itself. Because of Pakistan's origins, sort of as the younger brother to India and vulnerable to India, Kashmir was a bone of contention between the two sides. They fought a war over Kashmir in 1947 and 48 that Pakistan didn't quite lose, but made clear that they were on the defensive. An offensive by the Indian forces was called off by Prime Minister Nehru at a time when they might have succeeded and crushed Pakistan, but Nehru decided to take the issue to the United Nations instead. Pakistan saw that it was, as the weaker state, it was going to need assistance from outside if it wanted to confront India and prevent India somewhere down the road from completing what they feared was the dissolution of Pakistan. When Pakistan was formed, there were many conservative Indians, Mahatma Gandhi prominently among them, who thought there was no need to separate India. There was no reason to partition the country on any grounds, but certainly not on religious grounds. And so for many Pakistanis, they continued to fear that Indians harbored the desire to reverse partition. So this fear of India has always focused Pakistan in its security relations with the rest of the world, and initially made Pakistan decide to side with the United States in the Cold War context. As the Cold War developed after World War II, the U.S., of course, was looking for aid and assistance where it could around the world in its policy of containment of the Soviet Union. And South Asia was an important positioning location to try and create kind of a southern boundary to Soviet ambitions. There was always a fear in the 19th century and earlier about Russian expansion south, and that continued as part of the U.S. concern with respect to the Soviet Union. And so the U.S. tried to engage both Pakistan and India into what was called the Central Treaty Organization and also separately the Southeast Asian Treaty Organization. India, because it favored non-alignment, chose not to join either of those. Pakistan, because it feared India and because it sensed that it could take advantage of the U.S. desire to confront the Soviet Union, ended up joining both the Central Treaty Organization and the Southeast Asia Treaty Organization. And as you look at a map, a larger map of Asia, it takes some sleight of hand to figure out why Pakistan ends up in Southeast Asia, which it doesn't, especially without India involved. But Pakistan saw itself as a strong ally of the United States and one that would be able to assist the U.S. From the U.S. position, Pakistan was all connected with confronting the Soviet Union. From Pakistan's point of view, they wanted assistance from the United States to confront India. In 1965, another war broke out between India and Pakistan, again over Kashmir. In that war, President Lyndon Johnson decided to suspend assistance, military assistance, to both sides, both to India and to Pakistan. From Pakistan's point of view, this was the first time that the U.S. had abandoned Pakistan. Pakistan made a major commitment of its foreign policy to side with the United States, but then when war broke out, the United States, as Pakistan saw it, fail to live up to the expectations of Pakistan and cut off military assistance to Pakistan at its time of need. And the consequence from Pakistan's view was that they were not able to prosecute the war effectively. In their view, the U.S. had abandoned Pakistan. We sort of fast forward to the end of the 70s, 1979. Relations were problematic. But then in December of 1979, something happened that made Pakistan again front and center in American concerns. What happened was the Soviet Union invaded Afghanistan in December of 1979. Pakistan was now thrust back into frontline status in the American confrontation with the Soviet Union in the Cold War. And there ensued for the decade of the 1980s a close collaboration between the United States and Pakistan to support what they called freedom fighters, Mujahideen, in their efforts to dislodge the Russians, to force the Russians to back out of Afghanistan. And after a decade of cooperation, that combination, that collaboration was effective. And in 1989, Russia was defeated by the opposition in Afghanistan and left. Again, from Pakistan's view, there had been a very close collaboration between the two sides. They had supported the U.S. position. I remember talking with one of the leaders, the foreign minister at the time, and his comment was that they could have easily accommodated the Soviet Union. The Soviet Union had invaded Afghanistan, not Pakistan, but they saw that it was a threat to them, and they sided with the Americans. And under President Reagan, the U.S. wanted to confront the Russians in Afghanistan. And so from Pakistan's view, they paid a very high price. Now, another factor enters into this during the 1980s that was to complicate the relations then between the U.S. and Pakistan, and that's the issue of nuclear proliferation. The Pakistanis had decided to develop nuclear weapons, again, out of their fear of India. They had lost a separate war to India in 1971 that had separated the country. I haven't included the old part of Pakistan, but when Pakistan was initially formed, there was an eastern sector on the other side of India. But in 1971, war broke out between the two sides. The eastern sector of Pakistan became Bangladesh. From Pakistan's point of view, they needed nuclear weapons to confront India, to prevent India from, at some point, attacking the western sector and breaking it up. So from Pakistan's view, nuclear weapons would guarantee its security against India, where the U.S. might not. By the end of the 80s, U.S. non-proliferation policy was such that Pakistan had violated certain of our standards for what we wanted them to do. Despite the collaboration in fighting against the Soviet Union to get the Soviet Union out of Afghanistan, we invoked what was called the Pressler Amendment to the Foreign Assistance Act at the end of the 1980s, actually just in the beginning of the 90s, and cut off all assistance to Pakistan. From Pakistan's point of view, this was yet another example of the U.S. abandoning Pakistan, being tossed aside after the Pakistanis made a major commitment of their foreign, in foreign policy terms, and in terms of serving what they saw as U.S. interests. This period of abandonment, in a certain sense, lasted through the 1990s with some changes, but again, an event occurred September 11th when the Al-Qaeda forces attacked the U.S. that again, in a sense, saved Pakistan. When Pakistan was suffering the consequences of the U.S. Having abandoned them, of having sanctioned them for their nuclear proliferation behavior, and on September 11, the U.S. was now again, in a certain sense, in policy terms, knocking on Pakistan's door to say, we need your help in order to confront this new challenge to our own security, to engage in the war against terrorism. And from Pakistan's point of view, again, this was an opportunity to, even though they would have preferred not to have to sort of work in tandem with the U.S., but it was a way for them to, again, address this sense of fear vis-a-vis India, this sense that India was a threat to them over the longer term, and they needed help from the outside. And so after September 11, President Musharraf at the time basically threw in his lot with the United States to counter terrorism and join the U.S. Now, Pakistan has a strange relationship with terrorism writ large because historically, at least for several decades, Pakistan has tried to support what it sees as freedom fighters inside Kashmir to oppose India, to try and prevent India from consolidating its grip on Kashmir, and from Pakistan's point of view, to support those Muslims within Kashmir who would like to throw India out of Kashmir. So Pakistan has supported what's sometimes called asymmetric warfare or counterinsurgency, supporting militants within Kashmir to confront India. Well, one man's terrorist is another man's militant, and in this case, Pakistan says, well, we're supporting indigenous forces in Kashmir who want to throw off the Indian yoke, but from India's perspective, of course, these are nothing more than terrorists who are creating havoc within Kashmir, and that there are more legitimate and peaceful ways to resolve the issue. From India's perspective, Kashmir has full voting rights and full representation in the Indian Republic, and therefore the problem ought not to be treated as a matter of warfare between the two sides, and Pakistan should not support the terrorists. Well, this brings us up to the complication with respect to September 11th and the war on terrorism. Pakistan has wanted to exploit terrorists, militants in their terminology, in order to further their ambitions with respect to Kashmir. At the same time, they want to support elements within Afghanistan that will serve their interests over the longer term when, in their view, the United States again abandons Pakistan. They saw that the United States abandoned Pakistan in 1965. They saw that the United States had abandoned Pakistan in 1990. And they fear that the U.S. will do this again. And therefore, they feel they need to hedge their bets with respect to the Afghanistan confrontation. The key element, of course, in that are the Taliban. Where did the Taliban come from? Well, the Taliban were basically formed out of the refugee camps of the Afghans who had fled when the Russians invaded Afghanistan. They fled in front of the Russian forces, and they set up camps. There were some 3 million of them. For those of you who may have seen Charlie Wilson's War, that captures what that what that was like. So the Taliban were formed in these camps as part of the effort to bring order once the Russians left. When I say bring order, once the Russians had left and the U.S. had, quote unquote, abandoned Pakistan, there ensued for the 6 or 7 years in Afghanistan a very nasty and vicious civil war among those elements who had confronted the Soviet Union, who had helped to usher the Soviets out, but they were now left. The U.S. didn't have an interest there, had suspended assistance to Pakistan. There ensued a very nasty civil war among the different elements within Afghanistan. The result of that ultimately was that the Taliban, who were a very austere and fundamentalist, had a very austere and fundamentalist view of Islam, ended up unifying most of the country, but not all of the country. So the Taliban, from Pakistan's view, were a useful element to help to control Afghanistan, to prevent India from having any influence there. India historically has had closer ties to the Soviet Union and to Russia subsequently, and has caused Pakistan to fear that Russia and India are working together to influence events in Afghanistan. So from Pakistan's point of view, supporting this group called the Taliban was a way to neutralize India and neutralize any Russian efforts to hold sway in Afghanistan. So now, as we look at the relationship between Pakistan and the United States, the Pakistanis continue to worry that at some point the United States, again, is going to leave South Asia, that they're going to abandon Pakistan. Pakistan will again be confronted with facing India, with dealing with India having some influence in Afghanistan. And from their perspective, they want to exploit the Taliban to prevent that from happening. So they have a complicated relationship to this organization, the Taliban, which of course was housing, was giving aid and comfort to Al-Qaeda at the time of September 11th. Al-Qaeda formed its plans while it was housed in Afghanistan under the protection and effect of the Taliban. So from Pakistan's point of view, they want to have an influence on the outcome in Afghanistan once the U.S. abandons them again. But in the meantime, they have to work with the United States to oppose on paper and nominally the Taliban. Now, a further complication for the Pakistanis is that they themselves have come to be seen, the Pakistani government has come to be seen by many in this Pashtun area, the Afghania belt, if you will, between Pakistan and Afghanistan. The government in Islamabad is seen as sort of being America's stooge, as fighting America's war in this war on terrorism. And so the government itself has been targeted, and we've seen different manifestations of that. Benazir Bhutto was assassinated last December. There are periodic suicide attacks within Pakistan now More recently, a prominent hotel, the Marriott Hotel, was bombed in Islamabad. This was like a bastion for Westerners and a symbol of the West. And the fact that the terrorists based with the Taliban are able to attack that closely to the heart of Pakistan's government is telling Pakistan that they have a serious problem. They thought that they could develop this militant slash terrorist group that would be focused only on Kashmir or would be focused only on Afghanistan. Now they find these terrorists are turning their rifles against the Pakistan government as well. So even though at the back of their minds they want to develop a situation where down the road, if the U.S. vacates the premises again, leaves them in the lurch, that they'll have some ability to influence the Taliban and influence events in Afghanistan. But at the same time, they don't want to have those elements so empowered that they would be able to influence the Pakistan government directly. Let me go on to the issue of nuclear weapons, and it's a little bit of an aside from this, and then I'll talk a little bit about what the next steps are. As I said, Pakistan decided that it needed to develop nuclear weapons after the war in 1971, when India broke Pakistan in two, formed Bangladesh out of what had been East Pakistan. This harkened back to Pakistan's concerns going back to 1947, when they feared that India never accepted the idea of partition, never accepted the idea that there should be a Pakistan, and they saw no help from the United States. And so they decided that they would develop nuclear weapons. Consequences were serious from the point of view of U.S. nonproliferation policy, as I described it. But by the end of the 90s, both India and Pakistan had sort of emerged from a kind of covert status, a kind of under-the-radar status of having nuclear capability, and they both tested nuclear weapons in reciprocal measures. On May 11 and 13 of 1998, India conducted nuclear weapon tests, and then 2 weeks later, on May 28 and May 30th, Pakistan countered with its own set of nuclear tests. They were both sort of out of the closet and serious nuclear-capable states. Since that time, in the last decade, Pakistan has expanded its nuclear stockpile fairly significantly. It now has on the order of, most public statements are in the order of 50 to 60 weapons. They have delivery vehicles. They have aircraft for delivery. The missiles that they have for delivery are confined to South Asia. They don't have a range beyond about 1,500 kilometers at most within South Asia. So they're primarily, and according to the Pakistanis, exclusively targeted on India, in order to deter India from ever considering doing again what it did in 1971. After September 11, of course, people were very alarmed about whether or not Pakistan's weapons, now out of the closet, were safe and secure. When people talk about safety and security, there are sort of two ways to think about it. Safety is whether or not the weapon, if you were to drop it. Now, when I first thought about that, I thought, drop a nuclear weapon? Well, yeah, it can happen. If you actually got it loaded onto a delivery vehicle and you're mounting it on the wing of an aircraft, it might drop. Will it produce nuclear yield? Will it go off under those circumstances? What happens if it's in a jet fuel fire, if the plane crashes and there's jet fuel burning this nuclear weapon? Is it safe? How is the weapon constructed, and will it be robust under those circumstances? A separate issue is security. That is, once you decide you have weapons and you place them in a garrison, are they secure against attack? Are they secure against a terrorist, for example, trying to seize the weapon? Also, are they secure against internal forces? That is, are there insiders within your management structure who might try and seize a weapon and transfer it to a terrorist if that person is sympathetic to the terrorist views? So the U.S. was particularly concerned about this, given that the Taliban were supported by Pakistan, the Taliban in turn supported al-Qaeda, and al-Qaeda had attacked the United States on September 11, 2001. So I was working at the State Department at the time. There was a great concern just then that we better make sure and work with the Pakistanis, not just to confront the Taliban in Afghanistan and al-Qaeda being housed by the Taliban, but also make sure that their weapons were secure. Now, the U.S. had signed the Non-Proliferation Treaty, which was, I won't get into the details of that, but we could talk about that separately. And the Non-Proliferation Treaty prevents the U.S. from engaging with Pakistan because it is not a signatory to the NPT, the Non-Proliferation Treaty. The U.S. cannot work with Pakistan on safety issues. But Pakistan continues to say that their weapons are very safe, that they've put what are called permissive action links on them that will prevent anyone else from using the weapon if they gain access to it. What we can do is work with Pakistan on securing the weapons and securing the garrisons wherever they may be without invading Pakistan's sovereignty. But these two issues continue to be of great concern to the U.S. and great concern to Americans who are watching Pakistan as to whether or not these weapons are safe and secure. But the first question one might ask with respect to safety and security of weapons is, why not just get rid of them? Well, that's why I wanted to get into a little bit of the background for why Pakistan sees itself as needing nuclear weapons, because of their fears about abandonment and their fear of U.S. non-proliferation policy and their fear of India. So what is changing now with the new administration with respect to nuclear weapons? There may be a new policy developed under the Obama administration to try and reduce the importance of nuclear weapons. Now, I come from the Livermore Lab, and, you know, we're basically nukes are us. But we have a balanced view of it as well. It's not just that we have been responsible for developing nuclear weapons. We are supportive of U.S. policy developed by the president. So that new policy may have certain elements. One element may be to reduce our nuclear stockpile down to 1,000 weapons. A second element would be to acknowledge that nuclear weapons are only valuable to deter other states from using nuclear weapons. It's a very narrow definition. And that's part of the rhetoric that has come out of the Obama administration and some of the policy papers. There's a recent article in Foreign Affairs, the prominent foreign policy journal, that sketches out some of these new policies or ideas. Another element of this approach would be to ensure verification and monitoring of weapons around the world. And then a last aspect would be to lay out a goal of getting the world to eliminate all nuclear weapons. Well, that's an interesting and persuasive argument for a lot of Americans, but from Pakistan's point of view, it may be harder for them to accept. The idea that nuclear weapons are only good for deterring nuclear weapons doesn't really apply to Pakistan. From Pakistan's point of view, they need nuclear weapons and develop nuclear weapons not so much to deter India's nuclear weapons, but to deter India from mounting a conventional war against Pakistan that Pakistan fears it would lose. That's why they want nuclear weapons, and so they would not necessarily accept this idea that nuclear weapons can only be used to deter other nuclear weapons. Whether the U.S. reduces its stockpile has no bearing on Pakistan's need for nuclear weapons vis-a-vis India. If we have 1,000 or 10,000 weapons, it doesn't affect whether or not they need what they see as several dozen for their own security reasons. The idea of going to nuclear zero also would not necessarily resonate with Pakistan because, from Pakistan's point of view, nuclear weapons are not ethically bad or morally bad. They're also not dangerous to themselves, and they are necessary for Pakistan to ensure that India cannot take advantage of Pakistan's weakness. So the new policies that are being developed, and we'll see more of it as the Obama administration starts to take shape, as key people are placed into different positions throughout the administration, we'll see what the sinews of this new policy look like. But we need to think of it not just in terms of how the U.S. might benefit from changes in our nuclear policy, whether it be for moral reasons or distaste with nuclear weapons or the idea that nuclear weapons don't serve our strategic interests or security purposes very well anymore, given that the Cold War is over. Those reasons may apply to us, but they won't necessarily apply to other states. And in this case, it's part of why Pakistan will continue to be an outlier and an interesting policy challenge. Okay, let me conclude. I've gone on a little bit longer than I hoped with a few comments about next steps in our relationship. And the first thing I would say that we need to focus on is winning the war in Afghanistan. I think Pakistan needs to have a sea change in how it sees its own security. And I've described its relationship to India, its concerns about India, and its support for the Taliban, and its concern for having a hedge against the day that the U.S. leaves South Asia and wanting to support the Taliban in Afghanistan after the U.S. may depart. But before you sort of sort those things out, Pakistan needs to address that India is no longer a serious challenge to Pakistan, and that internal terrorism, a lot of it fomented by Pakistan's own views and its own policies, is a greater threat to Pakistan. And the way to address that is to confront the war now being fought on the borderland between Pakistan and Afghanistan. Part of this will be for the United States to expand its own forces in Afghanistan after the Iraq war, our commitment there is resolved. We will also need to draw NATO in to the war. Basically, our engagement in Afghanistan is a NATO conflict, not just a U.S. conflict. We will need to cooperate with Pakistan in planning and in training them in counterinsurgency. Pakistan historically is prepared to fight, has been preparing to fight a war with India, with fixed battle positions, with tanks moving across open spaces, and they're not well equipped to fight a counterinsurgency, which is what they're facing now along the border. And they need help with that, and we need to focus on that. There will be other elements than just focusing on the military victory against the Taliban along the border. We'll have to exploit police, border control forces, and so on. We'll need to train the Afghan army. The Afghan army is not up to the task of creating security inside Afghanistan. So that's a central problem that we need to address in order to bring peaceful conditions there, or something less than open warfare. We also need to think about a somewhat of a one-person policy that we adopt and tend to adopt with respect to different countries. People criticize the U.S. in Pakistan for being too supportive of General Musharraf and then President Musharraf, sort of having a one-man policy. To some extent, we're doing the same thing in Afghanistan with Karzai. President Karzai's regime is highly corrupt at this point. He's not governing the country. And so it's a tricky problem because you can't overthrow people, and that's counterproductive as well. But working with different elements within the country in order to create a less corrupt and more representative environment for the people in Afghanistan, I think, is also important. Without security, all of the aid and development efforts are difficult to bring about. And so that's why I stress the point of concluding this war successfully as what I think is a central element in next steps. With security established, then the assistance and development can take place and be more productive to bring about changes in the society that are necessary to make these things not happen again. Another key thing that has to be done is to reform Pakistan's economy. Pakistan is basically on the ropes. They just signed an agreement with the International Monetary Fund for another loan. This is a serious climb down for President Zardari, because he was hoping to get assistance either from the United States or from China. Both countries said that they would not provide economic assistance, and so he was forced to go to the International Monetary Fund. The main problem with that, from his perspective, is that it calls for economic and structural reforms that he's resistant to. Other elements that we need to focus on: Pakistan needs to reform its educational system. There's a large number of Pakistan children who are educated in fundamentalist schools run by Islamic preachers, and they preach little more than an extreme view of the Quran and nothing that will help the country develop. Pakistan's education resources are largely wasted at this point, and so reform needs to happen in the educational system. There needs to be a significant increase in Pakistan's production of power. Basically, they suffer through brownouts on a regular basis. They call it load shedding in the country. And so serious work has to be focused on Pakistan building up its energy resources. And then finally, institutionalizing democracy. Pakistan's in a transitional phase with respect to democracy. Last year, we saw a great deal of turbulence as lawyers tried to confront Musharraf, ultimately successfully, and then a fairly democratic election was held in February of this year. But in the transition, we saw how dangerous it can be when Benazir Bhutto was assassinated, and democracy is not just holding elections. So Pakistan needs to change its view about what it means to be elected and what it means to be defeated in an election. There isn't a tradition of being in the loyal opposition. When a party loses in parliamentary systems, you then need to take a position in opposition to the government, but not antagonistic toward it, rather loyal to that government and sort of trying to make it work better. Contrarywise, when you're governing, it's not an opportunity to persecute and prosecute those who lost. And unfortunately, Pakistan's history in the 1990s with democracy was largely one of persecution of the outs by those who were in. There's more to be said about Pakistan. It's a very complicated country internally. The U.S. is fused with Pakistan in important ways. You'll hear in another couple of weeks a discussion of India. I'd find that interesting, so because when I was working in government, one of the main things I worked on was the U.S.-India rapprochement and the civil nuclear deal, and I take a great interest in that. But without going any further, let me stop at this point. I thank you for your attention, and perhaps there are questions now that we can pursue some of these different issues. Thank you very much for your attention. First hand I see is right here in the second row. Yes, sir.
Thank you. I have a question because I have a recurring nightmare about nuclear India, China, and Russia confronting each other over a destabilized nuclear Pakistan. Is there anything you can say to alleviate my concern and assuage and rid this nightmare for me?
Well, let me ask a little bit more. What is it that you envision happening in Pakistan that would prompt these three countries to act?
Okay. The president-elect of the United States, in his last debate, I believe, he actually said he would, I guess he was trying to out McCain. He actually said he considered bombing Pakistan. If you destabilize the government in Pakistan, I can see the Indian Army running right through to the Khyber Pass and going to get what they always felt was theirs anyway. As soon as they do that, I cannot believe that the Chinese government isn't going to send their forces at least to their western border. And as soon as they do that, there's no way the Russians, I mean, they went into Afghanistan, I believe, because of China. There's no way they'll stand by and see that happen. And then where does that leave us and, you know, the rest of the world?
I understand the question better now, and essentially you capture one of the central problems that we face in working with Pakistan, and that is to avoid the complete breakdown of authority within the country. I don't think that complete breakdown is going to occur as a consequence of U.S. actions. I think the U.S. can help the mainly secular, mainly moderate Pakistanis who want to preserve the integrity of the country and do not favor terrorism. But as I've described it, they want to hedge against the day when the U.S. is no longer there. So that's the first part of the question. What are the conditions under which Pakistan might break down? The second part of it, I think, is highly unlikely. And our close relationship with India, I think, would serve us well. That is, in the event that there is internal breakdown in Pakistan, India has an interest, a strong interest in Pakistan not breaking down. And I think they would not want to have their own forces be engaged at all in trying to resolve internal problems in Pakistan. They would be very reluctant and unlikely, in my judgment, to take part in any kind of action or to take any action that would break Pakistan apart in more specific ways. Now, even if conditions got to the point that India felt for defensive reasons it needed to be engaged in some way in a military inside Pakistan, we then get to the next parts of your concern with China and Russia. And again, this is a judgment call. My sense is that China continues to be extremely cautious about its military engagement. It is continuing to be a country that wants to develop economically and socially, and it wants to make sure that it doesn't get engaged in any kind of international conflict that complicates that ambition. China historically, in my view, has been concerned about security issues to its east with Japan and to its north with Russia. And it's been less concerned about issues to the south on the other side of the Himalayan range. And it enjoys a kind of geostrategic distance from those problems. So I think even in extremis, China would do little more than offer resolutions at the United Nations and vocal support for Pakistan and condemnations of India, but in actual military terms would take no action. Even if they, for some strange reason, were to think through the possibilities of doing that, they would find pretty quickly that their ability to intervene is highly restricted. Their ability to lift, to engage in logistical support for troops at that distance from their heartland would be well beyond their means, and they would be confronting India, who is very well developed militarily, and India would be able to prevent that from happening. So I don't want to sound like a Pollyanna, but I think that spinning out of control is unlikely to happen.
Okay, that last part, though, doesn't China have a major highway going right through Pakistan to the Middle East? Isn't that one of the...
No, they have the Karakoram Highway that runs from China into Pakistan, but it's very vulnerable. Question in the back.
Well, it seems from the scenario you lay out, it's hard to see too many opportunities for hope, but is there, do you see the current government as having the stability, the capability, or any interest in really controlling terrorism, controlling the northern territories? And I guess the even deeper question, is there any feasible roadmap by which you can see it developing a viable economy by which its citizens will ultimately have an interest in protecting the company.
The problem is more on the what's called the federally administered tribal areas, which are more to the west than the northern areas. The northern areas refer to the Pakistan-controlled section of Kashmir. You can see that on your maps. Is the government able to do this? The government is able to do it. Pakistan is still a strong state. It's a question of will and internal cohesion. There are elements within the Pakistan military that continue to harbor more concerns about India than they do about the terrorists in the Fatah, the federally administered tribal area. So the government has the means to do it. It's not clear that it has the will to do it because of the internal divisions within the country and the failure to develop a kind of common purpose. And I've alluded to some of this in historical terms. I haven't done it in institutional terms. The military has had a predominant influence in Pakistan, and there's always been a push and pull between those forces that want democratic elections and the military that fears the consequences of domestic breakdown and feels that it's the only institution that can maintain order. So you continue to have this. I mentioned the issue with respect to democracy not being fully formed by any means. Democracy hasn't been anything Thomas Jefferson would particularly be proud of. And the Pakistanis are not particularly proud of it either. They see the problems with their own democratic elections and the consequences of democratic election. Nonetheless, the current president, Mr. Zardari, does have the means at his disposal to try and bring the country together. One problem is not just will more broadly, I recognize that, but also his status. His status as the widower of Benazir Bhutto, he doesn't have a political basis of his own. His political basis is his wife's status as being a member of the Bhutto family, which is has historically been a landed, rich landed family from Larkana in central Pakistan. His wife, Benazir Bhutto, was prime minister twice and is the leader of a popular party. His father-in-law, Zulfikar Ali Bhutto, was a very popular leader of Pakistan's party in the 1970s. And the family patriarch was a landed gentleman and a large landholder back even before partition. So he has a certain amount of cachet by now, but he doesn't really have the authority, nor can we tell if he has a sense of purpose with respect to the future of Pakistan. But you work with who's there, and so we need to continue to do that. Your last point with respect to what kind of economic change. There is one thing that would help, and two things. One is you have to eliminate corruption in Pakistan, which is very hard. Corruption also is a problem. In our country, we don't necessarily see it the way it is from the ground up. If a person in a country where there are few jobs and very little access to the public treasury, if someone in that family has a job that gives him access to the levers of power, if you will, that person now becomes an ability to feed many people, if you will, not through legitimate purposes, but through corruption. Because he can now, extort money from different sectors, and he does distribute that. I mean, obviously, Mr. Zardari, I should say, has feathered his own nest to an extreme that's really contemptible. But that said, corruption is hard to root out more generally. But there is also the issue of taxation, and taxes are a real problem in Pakistan. Pakistan never had land reform, and it's essentially a feudal agrarian country. And one of the problems in terms of extracting resources from the people in order to serve the country's interests is that there's no tax on agriculture. And the feudal landlords resist having a tax on agriculture, which means that there's a major potential source of revenue that goes untapped. So that's something that could be addressed, those two elements. Neither one is easy to do in Pakistan to make it develop economically. This lady had a question, and then this gentleman. In the middle. Sorry, back here in the third row.
Yeah. I'm going to just say, having recently traveled in India and spoken to various people, that the map ignores something which was glaring to me while in India about family genealogic connections and intermarriage and the extreme power of the ruling classes in India, which are almost equatable with the state. So to use democratic models where the assumption is that somehow it's not, power is not connected to family, which I'm not saying is not necessarily true here, but the myth is stronger here, doesn't really show how India and Indian families, say in Ajmer, have stakes in Kashmir, and how Hyderabad on this map is located in Pakistan, but if you travel there, your Indian passport takes you there.
There are two Hyderabads. I mean, there's one in India and one in Pakistan.
Oh, there's two.
Yeah.
Well, to me, that reflects something also of this mirroring techniques, which are very Oriental, not just Muslim, but Hindi, to mirror the other.
Well, if I could address your issue with respect to families, I think that's important to point out. It's another defect in democracy as it forms. Without addressing it in India, certainly there is a generational factor in Indian politics where the Nehru family continues to dominate the Congress Party. It's very much the same in Pakistan, that families have tended to dominate the politics, particularly with the Bhutto family. And that's another element that undercuts the development and the expansion of democracy within Pakistan. So your point is fairly taken, and certainly the maps, there are other maps one could draw, Pakistan and India as well, Pakistan for the sake of this discussion. Highly complicated, a very complicated country. It's got a lot of moving parts, and it's hard to keep them in order, and I don't want to overwhelm people by putting even more maps in your hand. There will be a test later just of what you have, and I don't want to complicate it. Sir?
Yeah, one comment. I have lots of, actually, questions, but I'll just limit it. I'm an American citizen of Pakistan origin. I was born in Karachi in 1948, right after 47, and I stayed there until 71. I did not see the third war when I was there, but I've seen the Second War, and I vividly remember that 1965 war. But some of the historical comments you made, a lay person Pakistani would say, at the best case is a rewritten of history, or worst case is mischievous, especially the name Pakistan. Pakistani, if you ask 1,000 people, not even single one would describe name Pakistan the way you described it. Pakistan, at the beginning, was four provinces of what currently Pakistan and Bangladesh, and your explanation doesn't even talk about how that Bangladesh came into being as named Pakistan. Only thing which you later said, Pak is pure, and that's how Pakistan came. So when you talk about ethnic city, that, I think, is mischievous in my mind. I'm sorry to say that. That's what people would see. And this is no different than you talk about three divisions of Iraq. People talk about four divisions of Pakistan. And that's a very, very troublesome thing for Pakistanis to hear. That's the first thing. Second is when you say abandoning Pakistan three, four times now. 1952 treaty, when the first thing started, and again, 1965 war, U.S. did not support Pakistan, not because they didn't want to do it, but Pakistan threw out the bases from Peshawar first because of after the first U-2 incidents in Russia. That's when Pakistan threw out. And if you remember, the Ayub Khan was the president at that time, or Marshall Administrator, whatever you want to call it. He wrote a book, which is a famous book, Friends Not Masters. And that was his thing to, hey, U.S., if you, that's what's going to happen, we don't want here. Yeah. So the third question I have is, when you talk about non-proliferation, why is always Israel exempted from there?
Well, you know, reasonable people can disagree. I think the origins of the name are pretty clear from Rahmat Ali's work. Mr. Rahmat Ali's work is very extensive. Talking about the origins, and most books, Stanley Wolpert's book on Pakistan includes that reference, a number of other points. With respect to nuclear proliferation, your last point, The point here is not to talk about Israel. The point is to talk about Pakistan. I'm trying to understand Pakistan's reasons for wanting nuclear weapons. I'm not here to endorse U.S. policy with respect to the prevention of nuclear weapons around the world. So I don't see any value right now to talk about U.S. policy with respect to Israel. I'm sure if you have someone give a talk on Israel, that would be an appropriate time. I have my own views, but I'm not an expert on Israel's views. I think Israel does have security concerns that drove it to develop nuclear weapons. And, of course, they've decided not to sign the Non-Proliferation Treaty, just as Pakistan has, so they're exempt from a lot of these issues. So what was your second point? Just more of a comment. Yeah, that's what I thought. This lady in front? Oh, here. Yes, please.
Sorry, I guess I got the mic. You mentioned the IMF and that Pakistan has just taken their second loan from the IMF, and I think the following sentence had to do with educational reform that was needed. Can you explain how that might work out? From what I know, SAPs generally don't assist educational reform, they generally make matters worse. So do you see something positive coming from the second IMF loan as far as what Pakistan needs to do with the educational system?
Yeah, I don't know the details of this particular loan, but historically Pakistan has not invested seriously in its educational system, and I expect that to continue to be the case. There's problems with respect to an agricultural society that doesn't turn to education the same way. What requirements will be forced on Pakistan with this current assistance package, I'm not familiar with at this point. But just looking at Pakistan's history of not managing its own social problems that well, over the last decade plus, Pakistan's been committing something like 40% of its budget to the military, something like 40% of its budget to repayment on loans, on indebtedness, which leaves only like 20% of their budget available for social programs, and that's not a lot. That's not a large amount of money. In front here.
Thank you. In the news within the last day or so is a report of another U.S. missile attack on foreign fighters in the border area, apparently achieving some of its objectives. So with that, one could argue, I suppose, that the U.S. attacks in the foreign fighters in the border regions of between Pakistan and Afghanistan are more effective than any actions that the Pakistani army is taking against the same foreign fighters in the same region. But their response, the official response out of Pakistan, seems to be almost pro forma and not really with the amount of outrage that, you know, one might expect if somebody shot missiles into your country. So my question is, you know, what is your view of how the military and the government in Pakistan see these U.S. actions against the foreign fighters in the border regions?
Pakistan's in a funny position. In a certain sense, they're saying, we don't want you messing around in parts of our country that we're responsible for, but we don't have the means to extend our writ of governance to those regions. So sort of stay out of these ungovernable areas. The U.S. position is, well, wait, there are people there who are targeting us, who have targeted us in the past, so we need to do something about it. The limit that the U.S. has placed on its actions going across the border between Afghanistan and Pakistan is, except for one exception, not to send forces on the ground, but rather just to use remotely piloted vehicles, drones, in order to attack targets on the Pakistan side. I think Pakistan's response is not, to some extent, depends on how much press there is and how much opposition is voiced internally and how much outrage is voiced internally. It is a violation of their boundaries to use drones against targets inside Pakistan. It seems that it's developed now that there's sort of a, not quite don't ask, don't tell, but a little bit of the U.S. is continuing to target those foreign fighters and those who are connected with Al-Qaeda and the Taliban in order to try and disrupt their ability to organize and disrupt their ability to counter both Pakistan and the U.S., and in a certain sense, buying time while Pakistan addresses this issue of not being well-trained to conduct counterinsurgency operations. The Pakistan's military has, been historically preparing to fight against India, and now you say go into these very forbidding mountainous regions and engage in counterinsurgency. We certainly have seen, the U.S. has certainly seen the problems of addressing counterinsurgency warfare up close in both Vietnam and in Iraq. It's very hard to do, and Pakistan is trying to do that. We discussed a little bit how much willingness there is on Pakistan's side to do it. I think there's enough will right now on the military side to address this issue because they see themselves being targeted by those forces. And at the same time, there is this public image of Pakistan being a sovereign country and not wanting to appear to have its sovereignty violated. And so this I think, will continue to unwind that way, where the U.S. will continue to target using drones but not sending forces across the border on the ground, while Pakistan sort of says that it's opposed to it but recognizes that it's not controlling that ground either, and many of those people being targeted are also enemies of the Pakistan government. Yes, please.
So my question is similar to the question about funds, the IMF funds.
Yes.
And then you mentioned that Zardari was turned down by the U.S. for funds.
And
I'm
China.
Wondering, and China. And so, but then we're also talking about potential training for insurgency into Afghanistan, which serves the U.S. purpose. So are there, in fact, funds for that particular reason that we're going to send into Pakistan?
Yes. The U.S. is prepared to provide military support rather than just block grants to the Pakistan government. And it would be for counterinsurgency training of Pakistan's forces to fight inside Pakistan, mm-hmm. not to come across the border into Afghanistan.
Right. And then
given current U.S. Budgetary problems, we face our own difficulties with respect to finding
allocated
resources.
But it seemed to have been important to the incoming president. He's wanting to take on Afghanistan, which means he's going to have to go into Pakistan, which means Zardari will get more money, which in turn supports, I think, like it's like a future of another tyrant coming into power and staying for longer than deserved because he does not have the people's support. So under natural circumstances, he probably at the very least would finish his term and go away or not gain more power. But I wonder if this money that we're going to send is in turn going to support Zardari where he doesn't deserve the support.
Well, when the U.S. provides military assistance, it tends to be more targeted. If you provide more general social spending support, it's somewhat more difficult to monitor. Ultimately, you're writing not a blank check, but a check that allows the other person to spend the money as they see fit, and money is fungible, so it can be used in different ways. We don't run an accounting audit of the expenditure of funds inside the country. They are a sovereign nation. So you continue to face that problem of whether or not the funds are spent, and we do the U.S. government does try to monitor it as best as can be done. One thing about Zardari is he was democratically elected, his party was, and so his term is limited. That doesn't mean that we sort of wait until he's turfed out. And then hope that somebody who's not corrupt comes in after him. But it does provide, a window that we work within, as opposed to it being a tyrant. I mean, someone who comes in by military force and is not going to be facing an election. There's a couple of questions in the back. I didn't want to ignore people in the back or elsewhere. So,
Obama said that he would make change, maybe in diplomatic attempts to solve problems rather than going to war right away. Is the hatred so deep in this area that diplomacy might not work instead of military force?
I'm not sure it's so much hatred as it is really quite different interests. And I will get back to the point you made, your second point with respect to ethnicity. I disagree with your point. I don't mean to cause offense to Pakistanis, but it's composed of different people with different ethnic origins, and the Pashtuns are very different from Sindhis in a lot of ways. There's interests in Pakistan and in Afghanistan that force them to take certain positions. So it's not just a matter of them being filled with hatred. They are protecting their families, they're protecting their tribes, they're protecting their regions. Obama faces a serious challenge there. He would like to redeploy forces from Iraq as he draws down the forces in Iraq and redeploy them to Afghanistan to fight what he sees as the central front. That is, in September 11th, al-Qaeda attacked the U.S. Al-Qaeda was housed by the Taliban. We then engaged in war against the Taliban because the Taliban refused to hand over al-Qaeda's forces and refused to end its relationship with al-Qaeda. So now he wants to refocus, President-elect Obama now wants to refocus U.S. energies to fight that main confrontation. I think he's been misrepresented to some extent. His views were not that he is now prepared to send U.S. forces or to encourage NATO forces to go rushing across the border with Pakistan. The point he made when asked on the campaign trail his position, he said if the U.S. had very good intelligence about the whereabouts of Osama bin Laden, would he be willing to target Osama bin Laden without the approval of the Pakistan government? And he said he would. In effect, he's restating policy, or he's verbalizing policy that has been part of U.S. planning historically. So it's not that different. The problem will be that he will confront is whether or not we actually can make a difference, and whether or not it's going to be possible to cooperate with Pakistan strategically and in planning terms with respect to how we both use our different forces, enhanced American and NATO manpower and firepower on the Afghanistan side, improved training of the Pakistan forces and a stronger commitment of Pakistan to the forces on its side of the border in order to achieve the same objective. What I wanted to give you some sense of was the complication for Pakistan in achieving that objective, because ultimately, if you eliminate the Taliban from their perspective, that's a sympathetic element that they would like to see survive in Afghanistan once this war is resolved. Pakistan does not expect the U.S. will remain long after Osama bin Laden and al-Qaeda are eliminated. And so they fear that there's going to be again a period where they need to face the threat as they see it from India on their own, and that will be potentially fought out in Afghanistan.
Okay, now one last thing.
This gentleman's been very patient in the front corner.
Okay, what are the plans for Pakistan's new Kashab's plutonium facility?
Pakistan's main source of nuclear weapons has been highly enriched uranium. They developed a uranium enrichment facility under Dr. A.Q. Khan, the fairly well-known Pakistani scientist who then traded nuclear technology. But in recent years, they've developed a capability to produce plutonium. The two materials that you can use for nuclear weapons are either highly enriched uranium or plutonium. Uranium occurs in nature in different isotopic forms, but only 0.7% of uranium as it's naturally found is U-235, that particular isotope. And if you want to make a nuclear weapon, you need to increase the amount of that isotope from 0.7% that occurs naturally to 90%. And you do that through a number of different mechanisms. What Pakistan developed was using centrifuges, basically to turn the uranium into gas, spin it at extremely high speeds, and then draw off the heavier isotopes, leaving behind the lighter isotopes, the U-235, concentrating that and making nuclear weapons from that. The other way to do it is you burn uranium in a nuclear reactor. In the process of burning that uranium, you produce a number of different isotopes. One of them is U-239 or plutonium. The plutonium is now contained in that spent fuel. After it's burned and you produce electricity, you still have that burnt fuel left behind. You then need to extract the plutonium from that spent fuel. That's a complicated and dangerous procedure, but it's essentially a chemical processing challenge. And Pakistan has, over the last decade, spent more time focusing on that element. The advantage people see in plutonium for a weapon is that you need less of it to make a bomb. So Pakistan is continuing to do that and shows every indication of wanting to expand that capability. But it's still primarily a nuclear stockpile composed of highly enriched uranium. Well, I guess that's it. Thank you very much for your attention. I appreciate the invitation to be here. Good night.
Okay, our thanks to Dr. Neil Jock and his very informative comments and handling his predicted tough questions. And thank you to our audiences. And this meeting of the Commonwealth Club is adjourned.